Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life Money Maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the path to prosperity. And just a quick update, we've recently launched the first of our private podcast series. And if you're interested in listening to the discussion on the topic of litigation funding with Robert Rothkopf of Balanced Legal Capital and myself, then you can find the conversation on our website, moneymazepodcast.com.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast. And we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
It's difficult enough to train to become a doctor and then practice in some emerging countries with fragile health systems like Papua New Guinea. But then to switch tack completely, give all that up, win a place at Harvard Business School and join Goldman Sachs in asset management before going on to launch your own fund in emerging markets may be considered brilliance or heresy, particularly when you come from a country that reveres technical expertise and is less enthusiastic about the merits of finance. I'm talking about Germany. And my guest today has enjoyed der dreifach Erfolg, a hat-trick of successes. So to unravel that exciting and unconventional journey, I'm delighted to have Dr. Christina Maguire, née Ehrenberg, CEO of Elephant Asset Management, as my guest today. Christina, herzlich willkommen. Welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Herzlichen Dank. Ich freue mich, hier zu sein. Thanks, Simon.
Well, let's start with your background. Were you from a family of doctors?
I was not. In fact, my dad was with the German Air Force and my mom was a bookseller in Germany. So far away from that.
So at what stage did you think that medicine might be your future?
So I have to admit to you that it wasn't a calling. I went to medical school because I got in, to be honest. And there's some status attached to getting into medical school, and you had to go through a special exam, and I had a good day and I passed it and I got in. The wonderful thing about medical school is it is incredibly interesting. It's very applied. You get to meet patients. You learn every day. I loved the interaction. I loved learning about the physiology and the procedures. And medical school is long, but it's very, very interesting and fascinating.
So I think you went to do some of your training, or I don't know whether it's called electives, in Hong Kong, Israel, Canada, and Papua New Guinea. And I read somewhere that you were the only doctor in one of those villages. You must have had some quite interesting experience. Please share one of them with us.
So Papua was amazing. And I actually wasn't on the mainland, but it was on a tiny little island called Kaka Island. There was one medical outlet there with one existing doctor and a midwife. And I had just finished my medical studies and decided to spend some time there and really learn primary medicine. With all of the beautiful imaging techniques and other technological aids that we have now in modern medicine, well, there you have nothing. And so you learn to see with your hands, you learn to assess a patient's health when they walk in. And it just really opened my eyes to what you can do as a medical doctor in those countries. One aspect I remember very fondly was, so we build up a mother and child clinic. It's actually, it's a very fertile country. But we had a lot of children, newborns, with malnutrition. And the reason, interestingly enough, and this was now, keep in mind, you know, 25 years ago, Coca-Cola had just started selling their wares on Kaka Island. And a lot of the younger mothers thought that Coca-Cola would be great for babies. And so they stopped breastfeeding. And of course, the result of that was malnutrition. And so we went around and talked to the moms and tried to educate them about what would be better. And it was a really, really great success. It was just fulfilling to see that. One other aspect that I thought was interesting was that in Papua New Guinea, women believe that children are a gift from their gods. And so during birth, you don't scream. And the women of the family gather around the mother and everybody sings together. So it's a wonderful ceremony while this baby is born, and it's full of music. And it was a very wonderful experience.
I think during lockdown, I think some of us thought that our children should be gifts for other people. But anyway. And so you are pursuing this fantastic and revered career. And at what point do you think, I want to change tack and go to Harvard Business School?
So as I mentioned, I really enjoyed practicing medicine in those emerging markets, came back to Germany at some point, and just decided after a few years that this perhaps wasn't for me. And I firmly believe that you should be pursuing as a professional career what you love, not what you just like. And one of the beautiful things about modern medicine is that because you have all of the specialization and you are becoming an expert in a rather narrow field of medicine, which is obviously great for the patient, but for you as the medical doctor, at least from my perspective, it involved a lot of repetition. And I just couldn't see myself doing that for the next 40 years of my life. And quite frankly, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do, but business school and MBA seemed to be a very good way to figure that out. It just gives you 2 years to make up your mind, explore other areas. And today I'm still very much in touch with some of my study mates from medical school. And when I speak with them and I see the passion for their profession, then I know I made the right choice.
And what was it that Harvard gave you?
So they put me into the poet camp at first. So poet camp was meant for everybody who entered the Harvard MBA program without a financial background. And I was one of these people. You mentioned earlier in your introduction that Germany is not so much known for their financial services. And you're absolutely right. I grew up not really understanding what equity was. And I grew up in a household where my parents didn't want to touch debt. And so it was very much a non-financial upbringing. Didn't know how to spell depreciation when I entered business school. So they put me through a four-week program where they taught us the ground rules and the ground vocabulary for the MBA. And after that, when you enter the actual program, the two-year program, you're just getting exposed to so many different influences. And I learned to love the financial part of it in the first year while you're doing your elective studies. And I went all into financial courses because I discovered that that is what really made me tick. And the exposure to amazing people. I remember Warren Buffett visited us at Harvard. I remember it was a session with Jeff Bezos, and the network you create, the interaction with other people from other countries. Our section had people from 72 different countries. The influences you are exposed to really shape your view of the world and your view of what you want to do with that education afterwards.
And how did you weigh up an investment bank like Goldman Sachs versus the other options coming out of Harvard?
To be frank, I did not think I wanted to enter investment banking or investment management. And the reason was I was a single mom at that time. My son was 6 months old when I entered business school, and I simply thought I can't work the hours required in investment banking. Then I applied for various summer internships in biotech and consulting, and I got approached by Goldman Sachs Asset Management, who told me that asset management is very different from banking, and the working hours are less strenuous and I should give it a try. So I did. I went and did a summer internship at the London office and was very fortunate to be able to work under David Blood, who left GSAM a few years later and is now, as you know, heading up Generation. And working under David Blood was amazing. He is a legend and was back then. And I felt like a fish in the water and decided and was very fortunate to be able to come back to Goldman Sachs Asset Management after graduation.
And you, I think quite quickly in your career, given charge of China's first A fund, which I think goes from 200 million to a billion, but had you already been positioned in the emerging market space? And if so, why?
I was not. I started at GSAM looking at European large cap stocks at first, at the pharmaceutical and healthcare sector, and then at various other sectors. But GSAM had applied for a so-called QFII license back in the days and received that license and wanted to build up an office in Shanghai. And I put my hand up for that because I felt I had some experience from my time in China there. Obviously in a very different capacity, but I really wanted to take that opportunity and come back. So in 2004, I took my son and moved to Shanghai.
And again, for the listeners, GSAM stands for Goldman Sachs Asset Management, but you moved to China, and how did you find that experience?
Back then, it was still very much the old China, but an emerging, very modern China. So you had old Chinese buildings right next to gleaming skyscrapers. So it was this really interesting time when China very much opened their gates to the world. You might remember in 2005, the domestic China Asia market started running, and it was still a time when minority shareholders didn't really account for much. It was still a time when a lot of the listed companies were toxic, but where you were still able to make a true difference with on-the-ground due diligence and by making sure that there actually is a factory, by making sure that the management is indeed doing what they tell you that they are doing, by analyzing financial statements. It was the potential for alpha generation was enormous back then. So it was a brilliant time to go there and to invest.
So you're all set again, just as you had been in your medical career, and then you want to go it alone. So that's intriguing. What was the motivation?
There were several smaller motivations that just came together to one big one. So at that point, I was back in London. So I returned from China in 2008. At GSAM, I had some fantastic bosses that helped me and supported me. One of my favorite ones left in 2010, and I felt that the new management was perhaps a little bit less international focused than previously. At that point, I was about 10 years at GSAM. I think there comes a point where you just have to make a decision. Do you want to grow within a company, or do you actually want to take a step away from that and try it on your own? And that time had just come for me. So I resigned from Goldman in 2011 and together with a business partner set up our first investment firm.
If there was one thing that you learned from Goldman Sachs above all else, what do you think it was?
The team is everything. The really fantastic thing about Goldman is that at Goldman, the team stands above everything. The biggest sin is if you do not share information and if you don't help each other. That is something that firm has never tolerated. And the fact that you cannot perform and you cannot get further just by yourself without a team is pounded into you from day one. So the team aspect of it is something that I will always carry with me. And at Goldman, we were always told not to write emails or anything with a pronoun I. It is always we. It is always we, the team. It is not I, the person. And I think that's a really wonderful message. And I try to continue to live by that.
So your first venture is in asset management on your own and it doesn't work and you've gone on to set up Elephant Asset Management, which we'll come to in a minute. But what was the lesson you learned from the first venture?
It was a really disappointing experience. I think there are several lessons that I learned from that. The first one is make sure that you and your business partner are fully aligned about whether you want to become big or whether you want to become first and foremost profitable. That sounds like an obvious choice, but it's really not. The other thing I would say is it is important to understand the financial position of the various partners because that informs some of the motivations about how to grow the business. And I was not the wealthy one in this team. And are you looking more at a venture from an economic point of view, profitability and so on? Or are you looking at how big you want to be? And I think those were things that I didn't quite understood when I went into this venture. And I think it would have saved all of us pain if I had.
So then you found Elephant Asset Management. I mean, I have to ask you, was there a particular reason for calling it Elephant Asset Management?
Yes. So I wanted a real word. Elephant, people remember. We invest in Asia and in Africa. There's an Asian elephant and an African elephant. Tiger was kind of taken. Elephant just seemed to us a very suitable name. And quite frankly, when we came up with this, we needed some thick skin after the experience we had just gone through.
Well, you've been awarded several prestigious fund management awards at your firm. And Will Campion, the co-founder of the Money Maze podcast, has commented that your approach is extremely unusual. You manage a very concentrated, stock-specific emerging market equity fund. And let's just start with why you chose that approach.
We want to offer investors something else, something that they usually wouldn't have access to. As you rightly say, we focus on companies that are less discovered. So we introduce a maximum of 25 stocks into our portfolio across countries that we selected in a very conscious way. The biggest compliment to us is that when a seasoned EM investor looks at our holdings and they say, you know, we don't know any of those names, that is exactly what we want to achieve. So we want to give you exposure to emerging market stocks that you won't have in other parts of your portfolio. And with that, diversifying your risk even more, but expanding your opportunity for returns. Looking at smaller company gives more opportunity for alpha generation. It shields you a little bit from capital flows that you often see in companies that are part of the major indices. They are less discovered by sell side. Many of our stocks are not covered at all, or just covered by a few domestic sell side analysts. There are not so many other international investors invested in those stocks.
So let's maybe dive into geography, sectors and stocks. And just you talked about your geographic focus, but presumably there are some common dynamics around population, middle classes. Tell me a little bit of how you think about the characteristics you want to see.
So there were two attributes we're looking for. The first one is we want to invest in countries where it's not just about food and shelter, but where there is an existing middle class that can afford some discretionary goods or services. So let's say a little bit of private healthcare, perhaps some low-end discretionaries, low-cost smartphones, something like that. But where the middle class layer that is in existence there is still very strongly growing. That's the first one. The second one was accounting standards. If you look at the countries we invest in, they all follow IFRS accounting standards. And we feel there is a large enough subset of companies that is willing to offer us the transparency we are looking for. Accounting transparency is really something that is very, very important to us, and we don't want to compromise on it.
So I note that it is a geographic weighting towards Africa and Asia. I'm going to put you on the spot slightly. No Latin America. Is that driven by avoiding commodities or avoiding corruption?
It is primarily avoiding commodities. We don't invest in oil and gas, predominantly because we want to focus on alpha generation. and commodities. We cannot and do not want to be all things to all people.
And as we dive into the stock component, only 25 holdings, pretty concentrated. What are the typical characteristics you want to see in your target companies?
We like to see a 5 to 10 years at least roadmap for these stocks. Our ideal investment case is where we enter into a company relatively early on in their life cycle and then grow with it as that company becomes larger and builds out its business moat. There are companies in our portfolio today that we have held at my previous firm and this firm. So they are kind of 8 years old in terms of their holding period. And that's not rare for us. That is the ideal investment case. It doesn't happen that often, but that is our blue sky scenario. We like companies where there is a structural, where we see a structural underpenetration of their goods and services in their particular home market. We don't invest in exporters because we really want to point our exposure to emerging markets and don't want to have secondary exposure to US growth or European growth or anything like that. So structural underpenetration of goods and services is important for us. And where we can see the company just building out their markets, penetrating that market more widely, and just growing as that country and its middle class matures.
We had Mark Mobius on the show, and he talked occasionally over the years about getting tripped up in the emerging market space through fraud, especially when the owner may have multiple business interests. And I just wonder how you try, because there are no guarantees in this business, how you try and guard against this.
Corporate governance is the one thing that keeps us up at night, to be honest. And you're right, we can never completely prevent it. We try in our due diligence process to mitigate that risk. And one of the things that is very important to us is our on-the-ground due diligence. We visit those companies frequently and in regular intervals. We like to not only talk to the CEO and CFO, but to various layers of management, the employees. We do a 360 on the due diligence front. So we talk to suppliers and to customers, to peers. We are trying to be as thorough as we possibly can. Also, because we have to, there are not that many sell-side reports on these companies that we look at. And so we substantially have to go out and do it all ourselves. And we don't get it right always, but we try very, very, very hard to minimize as much as we can the risk of fraud.
I've noted over the years, lots of people have said at times, well, I want to avoid emerging markets because of these sort of risks. And Luckin Coffee comes along and people say, well, there you go. But I think Wirecard has shown the Europeans they need to be very careful about trying to occupy the high moral ground when it comes down to fraud. Let's talk about your current portfolio. How excited are you about some of the companies you own?
It's an amazing time right now because the investment cases we have in the portfolio are mostly to 90% real structural growth story. There are a few value stocks in there, but it is predominantly structural growth story. Now, before the pandemic, our view was that it will take several years for these structural growth stories to play out. Growth stories like 5G, cashless payment, cybersecurity, all of that. The pandemic, the silver lining of the pandemic for some of our stocks has been that what management had envisioned in terms of progress for 2 to 3 years has been compressed into 3 to 4 months as people have leapfrogged into new technologies, have jumped over using debit card and credit card straight into e-wallets and have completely left cash on the sidelines. They have adopted much more strongly than we had anticipated e-commerce goods. 5G development has been accelerated. China, for various reasons, US-China trade disputes and so on, but also the pandemic has accelerated technological development. So everything that we thought we would get over the course of the next few years has suddenly been accelerated because it needed to be because of the pandemic. So we are very, very excited about the portfolio as it stands today. There are certainly a lot of uncertainties, a lot of risks that come with not knowing how long this will last and when we get the vaccines. But on a multi-year view, I'm very excited about the behavioral changes that the current pandemic has forced upon us. And I think the portfolio is ideally positioned to capture those.
And along the way, as all investors, we have hiccups in our stock selection process. Maybe just give us a sense of lessons learned from the best and the worst of your investments over your career.
We had a really tough 2017 because of one particular Indian stock that we owned, and that was actually our 2018. It was our best performance contributor in 2017, and just took an absolute nosedive because of rumors of corporate fraud that have never been substantiated. Nonetheless, the share price has just been clobbered into the ground. And it's been a painful process, and we do a lot of post-mortems on our holdings when we exit them or when something like that happens to make sure that we understand, were we lucky? Did we get it right? Were we unlucky? Or did we really get it wrong? And I'm not a poker player, but my husband is. And I firmly believe that process is everything. And when you have a really strong hand, and you play that hand absolutely perfectly, like it should be played, it does not mean you win. That does not mean you should change your process. If you do it the same way in the long term, over that period of time, you will come out looking good.
So you talked about post-mortem. I was intrigued. Ted Seides, whose US podcast show Capital Allocators was the inspiration for us launching this show in Europe, did a very interesting podcast on pre-mortems. And it's well worth listening to because that was not a concept that I had been familiar with at all, but it's taught that particular group a lot of valuable lessons. Can we talk a little bit about objectives and benchmark? We've become a slightly benchmark-obsessed investment industry. How do you think about what your clients should want from you? And alongside that, since you have to be judged, how do you think about benchmarks?
So benchmark in the emerging markets is a really interesting topic at the moment because China is overwhelming everything. Right? If you look at the MSCI emerging markets, China is now 40% of that benchmark. When you throw Taiwan and Korea into the mix, you're getting into the 55%. A lot of that is technology. So if you are doing what the benchmark tells you to, you are very concentrated into one reasonably narrow area of the market. And so by active fund management, you can diversify that risk more. Now, the other thing is obviously corporate governance. I think if you follow a passive investment process, the decision-making process, whether you want to invest into that company is taken away from you. I believe the active fund management, interestingly enough today, diversifies the risk more.
And your clients essentially are looking for capital growth over the longer term and are much more interested in the pursuit of absolute returns than relative, therefore.
I would argue that, yes. Yes, definitely.
Which brings us to talk about clients. How do clients, and you deal with foundations and large financial entities who allocate to you, how do they think about where you fit in their overall allocation?
The way we position ourselves to allocators is that you are lowering your risk and raising your potential returns. None of what we hold, we believe, will likely be in your existing portfolio. You will get a very pure exposure to emerging markets, no exporters, only home market driven, only stocks that are listed on the home exchanges. And you get exposure to stocks that truly participate in the EM growth story, which we know is alive. I mean, the last 10 years in emerging market was not so pleasant, and the growth story has been superseded by a lot of externalities. But nonetheless, underlying, I think we all agree it is still there, driven by demographics, given by underpenetration of goods and services. And by investing with us, we are trying to maximize your exposure to all of these things without diluting it with capital flows, with beta aspects like oil and gas or commodity prices. So it's a very pure exposure to EM growth.
And how do you find your clients?
Word of mouth primarily. We don't have a dedicated marketing person in the firm. We have a relatively limited capacity. So our maximum capacity is about $500 million. We want to keep it small to be able to generate the returns that we are envisioning for our clients. And we understand that this is not a fund for everybody. Volatility is high. It is small cap EM. And not everybody can withstand the volatility from a behavioral aspect and a financial aspect. And we believe that endowments, foundations, larger family offices are our main target markets. And we select those very carefully. And we have rejected money in the past because we felt that the investor was perhaps not as suited to the strategy. And we seek to establish long-term partnerships rather than just having investors in the fund. And I think at times like this, when you rely on your investors to trust in you, I think that's where the quality of your investor base really comes out and shines.
So you write these very interesting investor commentaries. I think you call them travel blurbs. And you frequently visit your companies. And I'm not sure how many flights and cities you've visited in the last 5 years. Post-COVID, is this going to change?
Yes. I don't have a very clear answer for you right now, to be honest. I had hoped that in the second half of this year, we would be able to start traveling again. And that does not look like it as we speak right now. We have never invested in a company that we haven't visited with and where we haven't spoken to management sitting in their offices. And I still think that is an integral part of our due diligence process. It is really important to walk the factory floor. It is really important to look at the research labs. And I find it hard to envision us investing in a company where we haven't done that. At the moment, we are still feeding off our library of companies where we have completed the due diligence process before COVID started. So those are companies that have been fully due diligence by us, where we have visited the company several times, and they just haven't been introduced into the portfolio earlier, mainly for valuation reasons. Those have been the source of our latest stock additions into the portfolio. But I realize that that will come off at some point and we would need to look at new companies. I think that we would make a distinction between asset heavy and asset light companies. I think asset light companies, such as software companies, I would argue that perhaps walking their office floor is less important because you don't really see much of their process. You can probably fill those gaps by Zoom calls and so on to get to know the management and talk to people who have been at their offices. I still cannot envision ourselves to invest, let's say, in a turbine manufacturer without really having seen the factories. And I'm hoping that by next year, we will be back in the position where we can travel.
How does the ESG narrative get expressed, if at all, in your portfolio?
We focus primarily on S and G because we believe that the social and the governance components are those that we can truly verify. You know, we look at the board, we can look at related party transactions, we talk to the employees. Our favorite due diligence part is always to have lunch in the staff canteen, because you truly see the social knitting of a company and how the interaction is. I'm very skeptical always about people who claim they can truly verify the environmental aspect in emerging markets, because I think the environmental aspect relies very much on government regulation and government enforcement. There is no way for me or for us to establish the amount of hazardous waste that comes out of a company. And everybody can show me nice data, but how do I truly verify that? And I don't think I can have sufficient comfort in the governments of the countries we invest in to truly and objectively enforce those regulations. Social and governance are huge issues for us, and it features large in our investment process. And we assign valuation premia to those companies that demonstrate above and beyond social and governance behavior.
So before we leave your investment philosophy, in a sentence, what do you think is your edge?
Our edge is superior due diligence of the companies we invest in, a sound local network that we can tap into to augment our own due diligence process, and the solidity and rigor of our investment process in general.
I'd like to turn to, you know, the issue of women in finance. How would you encourage more women to consider finance as a really worthwhile career?
I would encourage women to look at asset management rather than finance in general. I still think, and as a former single mom, I still would have found it difficult to do investment banking with the required working hours. I think asset management is a wonderful place for women to be, and I would love more women to consider it as a long-term career. There is a lot of due diligence that you can do from home. You can read and do phone calls while you're looking after your child or while you're doing other things at home. It can be very flexible in terms of working hours, and it can be on your own time. I always find it interesting that when you look at the analyst and associate level, in fact, the percentage of female analysts and associates is quite high. And we tend to lose them as we get older and the positions mature. And I'm not entirely sure why that is. And I would really like to see more women going further and going it alone and establishing funds and just trying to make it work. Because I think it is one of these professions where as you age, you are getting better. And experience is a true asset in this industry. There are not that many professions out there where you can say that it is perhaps better to invest with somebody who has 40 years of experience than somebody who has 5 years of experience. The hunger doesn't stop. So it's a wonderful industry, and it would be amazing to see more women participating longer.
And for you, what was the biggest obstacle you ran into, and how did you overcome it?
There are definitely more questions on work-life balance from allocators. And it might not only be because I'm a woman, but because our research process involves more travel and I have two children, and there is obviously an interest in how do you manage that. There are some very trivial little things that perhaps male counterparts don't think about it. And I give you a very simple real life example. Allocators come to our office and spend half a day going through the investment case and familiarizing themselves. And at the end of the day, you think, should I take them out for a beer? Now, for a male portfolio manager, that's something very easy. Whereas I think about it, how does that come across? Is that a bit odd? should I be doing that? And it's something very, very small, but it's something that we keep in mind. Other obstacles on a more general sense, being in a startup is a very difficult situation. It's a mental, a financial, and performance roller coaster. And you really need to want it. And tenacity is absolutely everything in this business. Staying in the game, getting the chance to do the process you adhere to over and over again, and not being tripped up by a bad year, but showing the longevity and the staying power of your process is so important.
And for the students who listen to this show, more broadly, what advice would you give to students thinking about their careers?
So I know that very often it is said you need to pursue your dream and don't compromise and go with what you love. And I think that's right. If you are so lucky to exactly know when you are 18 what you truly love. I didn't, and I would argue that perhaps a lot of other people also don't. And there are perhaps financial hindrances, commitment that you need to take into account, because perhaps you need to make some money and you can't just put all of the eggs in one basket. And what I would say is, don't worry too much. Whatever you choose coming out of university or secondary school, take it in, soak up as much as you can, make everything a huge learning curve. You can learn from everything. This generation has the amazing fortune of being able to have multiple careers. Our parents didn't have that luxury. We do. So if you start off in a job that perhaps you quite enjoy, but you realize you don't love, that's okay. Soak it up. Squeeze everything you can learn of it out and move on. Figure out at a later point what you really love, because you do have the time and the opportunity to switch. You don't need to get it right from the start. So don't worry too much. You will find your right place.
So I want to go back to a subject of Germany. Germany, of course, has produced and continues to produce brilliant technicians and engineers, the envy of the world, and was once home to banking dynasties like the Warburgs and the Schroders, but really has failed, I think one could say, you know, certainly at a banking level. Do you think that's cultural?
I think it is cultural to a certain extent. And I'm now speaking here as a person who's grown up in a very sort of middle-class household, and equity ownership is in general very low in Germany. And so a lot of younger people are not naturally introduced to equity ownership and financial investments from an early stage, contrarian to what we see, for example, in the US and to a certain extent here in the UK as well. So it's not something that is viewed as particularly aspirational. And it is not the first job that your parents would tell you to pursue when they sit you down to talk about your career. A typical German parent will encourage you to become an engineer, a lawyer, a doctor, but not so much a financial analyst or a portfolio manager. I think that is slowly changing, but it will probably take a few more years, if not decades, to get us up to the same level as we see in the Anglo-Saxon world.
Although some could argue it's the Anglo-Saxon world that needs to grow all towards the German model of investing and producing before they consume. I'm going to ask you a slightly different question, but why do you think Germany as a country is so reluctant to be more self-confident vis-a-vis geopolitics and airing its view and voice?
Well, our history still very much dictates the way we think about ourselves. It's a generational issue. I have still grown up in Germany learning about the Second World War and the Holocaust. And in my generation, we still feel very much the burden and the responsibility and the feeling of guilt and the hesitancy to really put our foot forward on a geopolitical stage because of everything that we've been through. Again, I think it is different now with the younger generations, and I believe that Germany going forward, although with great hesitation, but we are being pushed forward a little bit more on the political stage. And I think Germany going forward might take a slightly bigger role than it has in the past 50 years.
So, Christina, you're a doctor by training. You've navigated the path of all these companies during the coronavirus. If you had been chancellor in Germany, would you have done this differently?
Ooh, so you're having me now compete with a nuclear physicist. I think that, you know, from what I can say, I think Angela Merkel has done a remarkable job here. I mean, she's proven in the past to be great at handling crises. She might not do it in the most exciting manner and without much fanfare, but she is usually very effective. And I think she has proven once again that in crisis situations, she keeps a cool head. And I'm sure that her scientific background has helped her. And I'm also pretty sure that there is nothing I could have done, possibly not even better, but I would have handled it much less well than she did.
So I think that means you're going to stay being a fund manager for quite a long time and not switching to politics.
I hope so, yes.
So a very different and a final question is, let's just imagine you have a few spare hours. It's a summer afternoon, no Bloomberg, no email, no distractions. You can choose one piece of music, one bottle of wine, and one book to read. What would they be?
So let's start with the wine. That's easy. I think I would choose a bottle of Henschke. Mount Edelstone is our favorite. In terms of book, I think I would reread a book that I read about 6 to 7 years ago, and it is The Everything Store by Brad Stone, which is basically one big case study on Amazon. And I believe to reread it today, knowing how Amazon has done over the past 6 to 7 years, and knowing how it has particularly performed in the pandemic and the importance it has gained in society, I think that would be a really interesting read to read it from today's perspective. Music. If it was just me in the room, I'd choose Keith Jarrett. If my husband is in the room, it has to be Porcupine Tree.
Well, I'm going to do some music discovery after this show. Well, Christina, I have to say that's been a really fabulous and fascinating conversation. I think you've made very clear that some of these opportunities in emerging markets are overlooked by too many. And when you get under the bonnet and you look at them as you do in your business, it must be very, very exciting. And also that for our young listeners, the reality that multiple careers could be in front of them is a source of excitement and opportunity, not something to be afraid of. So thank you so much for being on the show today. And I'm going to look up a book and I'm going to go and find that bottle of wine.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time.